This is Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, our performing arts monthly program dedicated to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallblom. In February, Iowa's art scene takes over where the Super Bowl left off. This month, we'll check out one of the most distinguished and longest-running jazz festivals west of the Mississippi. We'll hear about an award-winning play that pays homage to Martin Luther King Jr. We'll speak with the artistic director of a newly established arts consortium. We'll learn details about the State Symphony of Mexico's upcoming performance in Ames. And we'll see what insights Simpson's director of opera and their guest scholar-in-residence share about their approaching production of a 17th-century Italian opera. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
I think the musical eroticism of it is something that has really taken the students by surprise. They can't believe how expressive it is and how real it is and how that reality is a musical reality.
I always think of opera as it's like seeing something in color, that the drama is great, it's in black and white, but when you add the music, it just raises it to the next dimension, and that's sort of how I feel about this particular opera.
Bernard McDonald, Simpson's director of opera and Larson chair of opera, and Simpson's opera guest scholar-in-residence, Jennifer Williams-Brown. They were discussing Simpson's upcoming production of the rarely performed 17th-century Italian opera La Callisto by Cavalli. Bernard predicts that the opera will spur insights across campus through interdisciplinary studies on awareness of gender, women, and sexuality. Simpson's associate professor of voice, Kim Roberts, was the one who originally suggested this opera.
As soon as she came up with the idea, I thought it was inspired. I knew immediately it was a wonderful vehicle for many of our talented students, and with lots of opportunities for interesting casting, large cast, double cast. So, as ever, the main idea was to provide lots of opportunity for students. We had never done one of the earlier operas, at least since I've been at Simpson College, and this seemed to me to be an opportunity to do something quite different. And this is really the crucible of Western musical theatre that is popular. And I wanted to be able to do this with students in a way that was historically informed. So rather than using our regular band of faculty and local Des Moines Symphony and, you know, those players, this offered an opportunity to bring in some specialist experts from outside. So we're doing Cavalli's La Callisto with a band that Cavalli himself would have been familiar with, two baroque violins, two lute players on theorbos, harpsichord and violone, and we're bringing players in from the Minneapolis area and a theorbo player from Boston. This also offered an opportunity for us to look at a broad collaboration, and we very luckily have one of the world's leading scholarly authorities on the piece in Iowa, who's on the faculty at Grinnell. So it was my delight to extend a hand to Dr. Jennifer Williams-Brown and invite her to join the team as a scholarly resource. She has been very involved in the past few weeks in instructing our students and doing some vocal coachings as well, and in helping us devise the production with our guest director and designer.
Bernard McDonald, along with scholar-in-residence Jennifer Williams-Brown, talk about the genius of Cavalli.
Francesco Cavalli was a composer in the mid-17th century, at the very beginning of the period when opera was taking hold as a genre. As some of your listeners may know, opera was a genre that was very self-consciously invented by a group of scholars and musicians in the years around 1600. But at that point, it was just a sort of academic experiment. And it took another couple of decades before people hit on the idea of actually charging admission for the productions and establishing opera on a secure, well, no opera's ever been on secure financial footing, but at least more secure financial footing with proceeds from admission tickets. And that's the beginning of what we call public opera. And that occurred in Venice in 1637. And Cavalli is someone who grew up in Venice under the tutelage of Monteverdi. He was a choir boy at St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice and was working alongside Monteverdi. So as Monteverdi was getting involved in this opera experiment, Cavalli was sort of watching from the sidelines and became involved almost immediately. His first opera was in 1639, just 2 years after opera had begun in Venice. And after that point, he produced a great number of operas, churning them out year after year. And so opera spread throughout Italy, and Cavalli's operas were sort of at the forefront of that spread. Also spread to other parts of Europe. And the sort of crowning achievement of Cavalli's career was when he was invited in 1660 to compose an opera for the wedding of Louis XIV in Paris. So he was in Paris for 2 years and composed a magnificent opera, Ercole Amante. Callisto is an opera that was written in 1651, sort of at the midpoint of his career. And the end of the career of the librettist Giovanni Faustini, because Faustini died just before Callisto went on stage. But the two of them had been collaborating for several years, and so it's really both of them working at the peak of their creative powers. And it's been such a joy for me to work with the students at Simpson College and just treasure with them every little note in this opera. It's such a magical piece, incredibly beautiful. To describe the style, it's sort of a period where the concept of recitative and aria are very fluid. Recitative was the really most important innovation of the development of opera, sort of what makes opera possible, the concept that you can actually speak in music and carry on a dialogue, keep the drama moving while uttering musical lines rather than just speaking. Later opera recitative can get a little bit formulaic, but in Cavalli's period, it's extremely melodious and therefore tends to resemble a little bit the beautiful melodic lines of arias. Also in Cavalli's period, we do have actual arias and ensembles, duets, trios, etc., but they're very, very tiny, so they don't take away very much from the flow of the drama. They just kind of evolve naturally. The recitative sort of starts to then become a little bit more melodious, more metrically measured, and then you know that you're in an aria. But then, whoop, 1 minute later, then it's done, and then you're on to more of the drama. So it's such a wonderful, perfect balance of drama and music. I don't think there's ever been a period in music history where the drama and the music have been so integrally united to a common goal.
Why is it so important to study these really early works?
Well, reason number one is that they're gorgeous. The music is gorgeous. The dramas are very engaging. I think it's perhaps a surprise to the students to realize that the characters, although they're ancient goddesses and shepherds from Arcadia and so forth, that actually they are human beings. They have all the same doubts and worries and obsessions and delights and joys that all humans do. And so it's very easy in a way to communicate those concepts through the vehicle of Cavalli's beautiful music.
And the whole piece is amazingly erotically driven. The eroticism is musical. It's the way consonants and dissonance are used. The longing for consonants comes from dissonance. And that dissonance is a musical metaphor, and it's an oral experience for everyone who hears it. We get it. We hear the desire in the music. We hear the love the characters have for each other. The other thing that's surprising, I think, to the students is how shockingly modern the piece is. These early public opera, the plot, as complex as it sounds, runs so the text kind of unfolds in a kind of stream of consciousness way. Although it's very beautifully crafted and highly organised, it runs in a way that is much more modern than later opera. Before, opera was more consolidated as a form in which there was very clear delineation between recitative and aria, and aria was so became a vehicle for star singers. This is not like that. This is really music as theatre. So it's amazing how this early public opera from Venice in the 1640s and 50s plays amazingly well to 21st century audiences, and I think that will be one of the biggest surprises for our audience, but it's also one of the biggest surprises for the students who are working on it for the first time. Also the fact that there is a significant amount of gender bending and pretty overt sexual imagery in the language, and some of it's verging on the body. This is something, of course, that also appeals to our students, who they get the humour. Because, I guess, it was a public genre, there's a wonderful mixture of high and low. The language is beautifully elevated in so many ways, but it's also incredibly pithy. And this is something that is you do not experience in later opera seria. It was designed to appeal to a broad audience. So there are numbers that are clearly entertainment, what we would call later, you know, musical numbers for in front of the curtain. So this combination of entertainment and drama and comedy and pathos is something that is universal and universally appealing. So our students are learning also that to perform this music, you have to be incredibly engaged. You are partially responsible for creating the dramatic structure because there is freedom within the musical style. In fact, it requires a strong intellectual engagement with the libretto in a way that you don't have to do, actually, in later opera, because there is a kind of provided structure. Cavalli was writing for the there and now, in the 1650s, he wasn't writing for posterity. So then the onus is on us as producers, as musicians, as singers, to create this as a living, breathing piece of modern musical theatre. And the production itself, well, how are we setting it? Well, we have a director, Nathan Troup, is coming from Boston to be with us for a month, and his design partner is Julia Nourin-Mirat. They're an established director-designer partnership. They've done several productions in Boston. Nathan works at the Boston Conservatory as Associate Director of Opera, and Julia runs her design studio in New York City. So they have, working with Jennifer and me, we've had many discussions. They have come up with a unified vision of the show that is modern but classic. So you might say it visually looks like sometime in the early 20th century. We're not necessarily being too specific about that, because mythology is timeless, after all. And the gods and goddesses will be costumed in a way that makes their status clear. Our costume designer is Jess Guthrie, who is on the theatre faculty at Simpson College, and she's our costume designer. So we'll have a modern take. It's modern theatre, although historically informed musical performance.
Bernard MacDonald, Simpson's Director of Opera and Larson Chair of Opera, and Simpson's Opera Guest Scholar in Residence, Jennifer Williams Brown, conversing about Simpson's upcoming production of the opera La Callisto by Cavalli. La Callisto performances will be held on February 13th through the 15th at the Blank Performing Arts Building on the Simpson College campus in Des Moines. For more details and to order tickets, go to simpsonmusic.tix.com or call 515-961-1637. You may also find a synopsis of the show by going to the Simpson Music Department page, clicking on Opera at Simpson link, and then clicking on 2014-15 Simpson College Opera Season. Tonight at 7:30 and tomorrow afternoon at 2, the UNI Opera will present The Merry Wives of Windsor in Russell Hall on the UNI campus in Cedar Falls. On February 13th at 12:15 p.m., the Northern Iowa Bach Cantata Series will continue in the Gallagher Blue Dorn Lobby on the UNI campus. On February 15th at 4 p.m., the Nova Singers will sing at the St. Paul Lutheran Church in Davenport. On February 21st at 1:30 p.m., the Iowa State Singers will perform at the Martha Ellen Tye Recital Hall on the ISU campus in Ames. Also on the 21st, the Cedar Rapids Concert Chorale will present a Masterworks Haydn and Bach concert at 7:30 p.m. at the First Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids. Just ahead, an award-winning play delving into the last day of Martin Luther King Jr.'s life. A newly established arts organization offers their premier performance of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. The State Symphony of Mexico returns to Iowa, and jazz trumpeter Dave Douglas heads to the state. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
You're going to hear two of the very best college big bands in the country. And when I listen to Dave's music, he's really a pioneer of just new music in general. And I know a lot of people are kind of turned off by the phrase new music, but there's a lot of really nice symphonic elements to his music and to his playing, too. He's got a really, 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 really big, big trumpet sound that I just love listening to. He dabbles a lot with changing up the instrumentation in his groups as well. You know, there's a vast array of like woodwind doubles, but just for the sake of hearing something that's so fresh and so original and so different than any other jazz that you may be used to listening to, is going to be much, much, much worth your while to come to this concert.
And his playing has such a broad palette. He will play things that are singable and beautifully melodic and almost folk-like in character, and then you'll turn right around and play what people sometimes call snake charmer music that's just super chromatic and coming right out of the Miles Davis tradition. So I think if you're a fan of beautiful melody, you'll hear some beautiful melody. If you're a fan of very edgy chromatic playing, you'll hear some of that too, and everything in between. He can be lyrical and he can be hard-hitting.
Junior instrumental music education major and UNI's Tall Corn Jazz Festival chair, trombonist Paul Lichty, and UNI's Professor of Jazz Studies, Associate Professor of Music and Director of Jazz Band 1, Chris Mertz. They're talking about UNI's Tall Corn Jazz Festival and their Symphonian Dimensions in Jazz concerts, being held on the 20th and 21st of this month, featuring guest trumpeter, composer, and educator Dave Douglas. Festival musicians will participate in a noontime clinic each day, focusing on improvisational skills with Dave Douglas, in addition to attending evening concerts highlighting the trumpet virtuoso along with Jazz Band 1. Chris and Paul continue discussing UNI's jazz legacy.
Well, the Tall Corn Jazz Festival, as far as we know, I believe it's for sure the oldest jazz festival this side of the Mississippi, maybe one of the oldest continuing jazz festivals in the country, for sure. The Tall Corn Jazz Festival is going on to its 60th year, and this is my first year being like the head guy in charge of it. Last year, I was kind of like the secondary guy to Nolan Schrader, and we invite bands from all across the state, and there's actually this year a couple of bands coming from out of state that are wanting to compete, and I speculate that it's probably because of we're bringing in Dave Douglas, and he's such a huge name. In fact, I know that's the reason.
You have a history with this festival. Tell us a bit about how this festival has dramatically affected your life.
I had been interested in coming to UNI ever since my junior year when I actually saw Jazz Band 1 for the first time. And I knew of the Tall Corn Festival, but we had never gone because there would always be a show choir competition that exact same weekend. But our senior year, we had a new choir director. She decided not to go to that show choir competition. So I tried to convince my band director, Brad Jensen, to go to Tall Corn, and we did. And that was the year Peter Applebaum was the guest artist. And of course, my band director, being the good band director that he was, he brought his band to the SCIJ concert, and I was floored by how awesome that concert was. And it was one of my favorite moments of my senior year, for sure. And that's how I met Antonio Garza for the first time. He told me to buy the Let Go Jazz Band 1 CD. It was really fun. Got to mingle with a little bit of the symphonies. That's how I found out about the group, and that's how I found out that my band director was a symphony, and that's initially how I got to be interested in the group before I even came to UNI. And I've always been a big fan of the jazz program here, and it was just great to spend some time at the school.
Quite a history and a good way to come to you and I.
Yeah.
Chris, tell us then about this amazing festival that you're going to have. You have concerts, you have this competition going on, lots of things.
Yeah, it's kind of a two-part event. We have the Tallcorn Jazz Festival, which is the competitive part, and that's for high school jazz bands from all around the state, and as Paul pointed out, a few bands from out of state. There's a school from Champaign, Illinois that's bringing three bands, and I believe there is a band coming from Minnesota as well.
Yep.
And in fact, the bands that are coming from Champaign, the band director there is an old friend of mine from UMass Amherst days. So we met up again at a reunion concert a couple of years ago, and he said, yeah, I understand you have a festival. I said, yeah, it's a great festival. You should bring your bands. Next thing I know, he's rattling my chain about bringing his three bands, which I'm very excited about. And then in addition to the competitive aspect, we also have a major guest artist coming in who will perform with Jazz Band One on what has been known as Symphonian Dimensions in Jazz. Now, that concert actually predates the Tallcorn Festival. The SDIJ concerts stretch back at least a few years before the advent of the Tallcorn Festival. And those concerts were originally called Jazz at the Commons, which was a sort of a takeoff on Jazz at the Philharmonic, which was a famous series of concerts. So we have this amazing trumpet player coming in. Each year we bring in a new guest artist, and it's always somebody thought-provoking and interesting and at the top of their game. We always try to find somebody who's current and who will get the students excited and also put on a great show for the audience. Dave Douglas, in my opinion, is the foremost voice of his generation on the trumpet and also as a composer. You know, we always think about jazz primarily as a performer's art, which it is. You know, it's really about improvisation and the playing of the music. But since the advent of the music, there have been a lot of prominent composers, stretching all the way back to Jelly Roll Morton and extending through Duke Ellington to Wayne Shorter. And Dave Douglas would certainly be a part of that lineage. And he has a tremendously varied output, and the pieces are very different from one another. So I think there'll be something for everybody on the concert.
Tell us a little bit more about Dave. He's got an amazing number of bands and just a huge variety of music that he's actively involved in.
Yeah, you know, and he kind of, in his playing and writing, he will cover the spectrum of the music. He has some things that owe a very clear debt to the earliest days of jazz. He has some groups that have some collective improvisation, yet at the same time, he has some groups that are very electronic in nature. So what he's going to play with us, primarily, are compositions from an album he did called A Single Sky, which is his only big band record. And that features his compositions arranged both by himself and also McNeely. Jim is a very prominent big band writer living in New York. He's originally from the Chicago area, but he's been in New York for many, many years now.
UNI's Professor of Jazz Studies, Associate Professor of Music and Director of Jazz Band One, Chris Mertz, along with UNI's Junior Instrumental Music Education Major and UNI's Tallcorn Jazz Festival Chair, trombonist Paul Lichty. To find out more details about UNI's Tallcorn Jazz Festival and Symphonian Dimensions and Jazz Concerts on February 20th and 21st, please visit uni.edu/music/events. Performances will be held in Bankston Auditorium in Russell Hall on the UNI campus in Cedar Falls. For tickets, see uni.edu/tickets. Tickets will also be available at the door. Tonight at 7, Iowa Public Radio is hosting their Blues Blowout 2015 at the Electric Park Ballroom in Waterloo. On February 13th at 7 and 9:30 p.m., Hancher is presenting the Terrell Stafford Quintet at the Mill in Iowa City. ISU's Jazz Ensembles 1 and 2 will perform on February 18th, and ISU's Jazz Combos will perform on February 26th. Both concerts will be held at 7:30 p.m. at the Martha Ellen Tye Recital Hall on the ISU campus in Ames. On February 21st, Synergy Jazz presents Erica von Kleist at the Turner Jazz Center at 7:30 p.m. on the Drake campus in Des Moines. On February 24th, the UNI Jazz Combos appear in concert at 7:30 p.m. in UNI's Russell Hall in Cedar Falls. The UNI Jazz Trio presents a concert in Studio 101 in Russell Hall on February 27th at 3 p.m. And Coe College hosts their Jazz Summit Finale Concert on February 28th at 7 p.m. at Sinclair Auditorium in Cedar Rapids. Don't go away. Mozart's Marriage of Figaro takes the stage at the Coralville Center for the Performing Arts. See why Stevens presents the State Symphony of Mexico in concert early next month, and the opportunity to imagine the last day in Martin Luther King Jr.'s life. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
It is a wonderfully written play that is funny, that is interesting, that shows a new side of King that most people don't know, and really then pivots and turns the focus not on just Dr. King's work, but on us to continue his work. So it's a wonderful way of gifting our community with art, but also promoting conversations that are very timely.
The Minister of Music and Fine Arts at Westminster Presbyterian Church in Des Moines, John Cook. Westminster Presbyterian is producing a new award-winning one-act play called The Mountaintop by Katori Hall. Hall imagines the final hours of the day of Martin Luther King's assassination. In this powerful play, Dr. King comes face-to-face with his own fate and final gift. John continues talking about the goals of Westminster's Fine Arts series.
Our mission is to provide high-quality works of art absolutely free of charge to our community. We've just recently completed a weekend run of Stravinsky's L'Histoire du Soldat, and we're getting ready for Katori Hall's The Mountaintop, a wonderful play about the last night of Martin Luther King's life.
How did you decide you wanted to do this? Was this just because February is Black History Month? How did you decide you wanted to do this play?
You know, it's interesting. It's kind of serendipity. I fell in love with the play, and it just so happened that February was a good time for the schedule and for the artists that we were contracting. But after we finished our last production last year, we really didn't have any ideas of where we were going to go. So I went on Amazon and I ordered 7 different scripts, and they all came in the same box. Mountaintop was the first one I pulled off. I read it in one sitting, and the other 6 are still sitting in the box because I just fell in love with it and said, okay, this is the one we have to do. It's powerful, it's funny, it's wonderful. It also, I will tell you, as a liturgical nerd, we're going up the same weekend of Transfiguration Sunday, which is Christ's experience on the mountaintop. And so it's a really interesting kind of parallel for us as a church to be putting this on.
Tell us about who the artists are who will be joining the cast on this. It's a small cast, and also who your director will be.
Yes, it's a great opportunity for us to partner with Integral Artists Theater, who this will be our 4th collaboration with them over the last couple of years. And it's a 2-person play. One actor portrays Dr. King, and another actress plays a housekeeper. Her name is Kameh. Actually, interestingly enough, that was Katori Hall's mother's name. So Kameh is a kind of amalgamation of different parts. And it's just a 2-person play. Aaron Smith will be playing Dr. King. Des Moines audiences will have seen him on stage at the Playhouse, and most recently he did a wonderful job as the lead in August Wilson's Fences that was held at the Social Club. Tiffany also played his wife in Fences, and the female lead did a wonderful job herself. Tiffany Johnson is her name, and she's a wonderful actress here in town. Ron Gilbert is our director. He's the founding director of Integral Artists Theater, and he is helming this project and helping us get home.
Now, you just mentioned Kameh and the relationship to the mother of Katori Hall, and that's sort of how she got her inspiration for even coming up with this idea.
Yeah, she wanted to tell her mother's story in a way. Katori Hall is a wonderful playwright. She's educated at Columbia and again at Juilliard. And this play that she wrote actually won the Olivier Award in 2011. It's kind of the British Tonys. She wanted to tell her mother's story. Her mother grew up in Memphis and was going to be present at what turned out to be Dr. King's last speech on April 3rd, 1968. But her mother, this would be Katori Hall's grandmother, kept her mother from going. There was a bomb threat. There was just all kinds of angst around the event. And with April 4th coming and Dr. King's assassination coming the next day, Katori said that her mother would tell the story as one of the greatest regrets of her life, that she never got to hear Dr. King's words in the flesh. And so I think in a way, Katori's kind of writing to talk about Dr. King, but also to kind of tell her mother's story as well.
Give us a synopsis of this plot.
Yeah, it's a wonderful piece about the man behind the myth. Katori Hall says she really wanted to write the play about a person, not a saint. And so we see King on the final night of his life, warts and all, but being able to summon the strength to carry on and do these great things that we all know and remember him by. Kameh is a housekeeper. It happens to be her first night on the job, and she comes up late. The play picks up right after King has returned from the Mason Temple in Memphis, having given what will be his last public address, comes to be known as the Mountaintop Speech. And between the two of them, they converse about all manner of things. His faults, his hopes, his aspirations, his strengths, his weaknesses, his dreams, the movement itself, violence versus nonviolence. And it's a wonderful exploration of the person King as well as the saint King.
And this is for more mature audiences?
Yes, it does contain adult language throughout, so I wouldn't recommend it for preschool age, but it's a wonderful piece for teens and adults to come and to learn about Dr. King, to learn about who he was, what he believed, and then as a jumping off point, what I'm really excited about is the play ends with Dr. King addressing the audience specifically and challenging us as members of, you know, this century to pick up his work and continue. And so I think it'll be a great way for people to learn not only about Dr. King, but also to learn about civil rights movements in this country that are still going on.
Westminster Presbyterian is going to be hosting this for 2 weekends. Give us the dates and how folks can get more information.
Absolutely. We go up February 13th, and we will run Friday and Saturday and Sunday. So that'll be the 13th, 14th, and 15th. And then we'll run the next weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, the 20th, 21st, and 22nd. Friday and Saturday shows are at 7 o'clock, and then the matinee on Sunday is at 3 o'clock. All tickets are free of charge, but I will say that our chapel is limited, and so we're asking people to call ahead and make reservations, and we'll have a list of people, and then we'll release the list if anybody doesn't show up or doesn't claim their seat. But you can call the church office at 515-274-1534, or you can visit our website, which is westminsterfinearts.org.
And on February 8th, 15th, and 22nd, you're going to be doing some special classes or panel discussions. Tell us about those.
Well, this is what I absolutely love about art in the context we get to present it. Not only do we get to give it away, but we get to use it to promote really important and pertinent discussions. And so a lot of members of our church have a history of working civil rights here in Des Moines, met Dr. King when he came through in the 50s, worked on school desegregation. And so we're going to be building a series of classes around that. So there'll be one panel that the actors and I and Ron will be sitting down to talk about the play, but then we also have a panel that we're building on the history of desegregation here in Des Moines with folks who actually participated in the famous Supreme Court case and then the actual desegregation of schools here. And then, like I said, because the play pivots us and really challenges us, it's a great opportunity to talk about people who are on the front lines of civil rights changes, not only here in Des Moines, but also across Iowa and the Midwest.
The Minister of Music and Fine Arts at Westminster Presbyterian Church in Des Moines, John Cook. Westminster Presbyterian Church is located at 4114 Allison Avenue in Des Moines. Tonight at 7 and tomorrow afternoon at 2, the Stebbins Children's Theater in Mason City will present Little Red Riding Hood. Tonight at 7:30, Hancher will present the Kronos Quartet performing Beyond Zero, 1914 to 1918, a new work for quartet with film at the Englert Theater in Iowa City. The Montana Repertory Theater will present The Great Gatsby on February 12th at the Iowa State Center in Ames. They will also present The Great Gatsby on February 14th at the Dubuque Heritage Center in Dubuque. Both performances start at 7:30 p.m. The Des Moines Arts Center will display the show Field Road Cloud, Arts in Africa, from February 14th through the 19th. Ballet Quad Cities and Orchestra Iowa will perform Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet on February 14th at 7:30 p.m. at the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids. Just ahead, the State Symphony of Mexico returns to C.Y. Stevens for another dazzling performance. And a newly established performing arts troupe in Iowa proudly presents one of Mozart's most famous operas. This is the Iowa Arts Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
We have two components, basically. It's a performing arts organization. One is a chamber orchestra, and one is this incredible troupe of singer-actors that can do anything from opera to musicals to jazz. We do symphony concerts, chamber music. The troupe itself has so much diversity and is so talented, we could even do a tap dance seminar if we wanted to. So someone asked me to be the artistic director of this, and I assembled an amazing group of musicians. And we have our inaugural season right now, and we're just very excited to have our first stage production be Mozart's great masterpiece, The Marriage of Figaro.
The artistic director of Concertia, Sherry Rhodes. How wonderful it is to have a new creative arts ensemble starting in Iowa. It's particularly exciting when one of Concertia's goals is to connect Iowa artists with Iowa communities.
As a professor for so many years here, I saw that we were graduating many talented singers and musicians, and they were not being employed within their state, so they had to go away, even though they wanted to stay in the state of Iowa. And so one of our goals is to bring high-quality performances by employing Iowa-based or Iowa natives, or Iowa-educated musicians and singers, and to bring them to not only the communities where we're based, which is between Coralville at the Center for the Performing Arts and then down at the Sondheim Center in Fairfield, but to explore all these fantastic renovated opera houses around Iowa. We have many of those that have been renovated, and they're in arts underserved areas, and so we're excited to bring these high-quality concertia performances to the state of Iowa.
And you're also bringing in two guest directors. Just tell us briefly about the two other shows you're going to be doing this year.
For Marriage of Figaro, it's Georges Delnaux, who is my longtime collaborator, 22 years of doing Mozart workshops in Italy and Switzerland. And in fact, one of the reasons why he's doing this is because I took so many students abroad when I was a professor at the University of Iowa, and he loved the Americans, or the Amis, as they called them. And so he said, listen, we need to do the Marriage of Figaro. I want to come to America. I'll waive my fee, and I'll come to Iowa. This is extraordinary because he is the head of the Hamburg Opera, the big Hamburg Opera. He is on the cutting edge of everything that's exciting in opera in Europe, is currently finishing his tenure at the Basel, Switzerland Opera House. And so that's one of our guest directors. Then two-time Tony Award-winning director and choreographer Adam Cates and I are developing a children's show, a multimedia children's show, which we're very excited about, based on Stravinsky's L'Histoire du Soldat, which is the tale of a soldier. And we have reworked it, and we are going to be employing puppetry and masks and large life-size puppets, multimedia, an actress on silks. So we're very excited about that and plan to have Johnson County, Linn County, and Washington County elementary students see this show.
And then next year for the holidays, you have a holiday favorite planned.
Well, yes, I have to say, after a long career, that Plaid Tidings is in the top five things that I've ever done. It's four guys who didn't make it very big, you know, backup singers, and they're killed in a car crash. They go to heaven, and they get a chance to come back and sing, and it's full of things like Ed Sullivan show references and Perry Como. It's hilarious, and it's very poignant, too, and full of tight four-part harmonies. And we even have two finalists for American Idol that are part of this. And they have Iowa ties. They've been in Iowa. They were educated in Iowa. So we're very excited to bring these performances and these events to Iowa communities.
You're going to be doing The Marriage of Figaro here early in March, but you also have something happening in February. Tell us about your production.
Right. The Marriage of Figaro, we're very excited about that. It's March 6th and March 8th at the Center for the Performing Arts in Coralville. We are updating it from 1786 to the 21st century, and don't let that scare you, anyone who's listening. Actually, the relationships between man and woman and husband and wife and the social strata is the same in 1786 as it is in the 21st century. One of the reasons we're updating it is because we believe that human emotions are still the same. But also, we wanted to take the financial resources that we have and put them into the musicians' and singers' salaries instead of having sumptuous sets and incredible costumes and yet paying the musicians practically nothing. So that was an artistic choice that we made. Updating it means that we'll be in contemporary dress with some of the most beloved alums from the University of Iowa and schools around Iowa. And for that, on February the 22nd, we have a preview. And that will be in the lobby of the CCPA, of the Coralville Performing Arts Center. We're very excited about it. It's at 2 o'clock. The singers will be able to meet the public. It will be very informal. I'll be emceeing from the piano. And we will explain the plot, because we are performing this in Italian. And we have English supertitles, which I've done a new translation, and we're excited about that. But we think that it's important for anyone who wants to meet the singers or hear them live within 15 feet would enjoy the preview, and also understanding the plot line, which is sometimes a little confusing in opera, especially in Mozart opera.
And that is free and open to the public on the 22nd of February?
Yes, with refreshments.
A marvelous opportunity and a great way to dive in and just maybe get your big toe wet if you have never been to an opera before and you're kind of scared of it. This will be a great opportunity.
I think so, too. And what we found out by watching the audience, there were many people that had never been to an opera, and they came up to us afterwards and said that because of the incredible acting, they understood everything, plus the supertitles helped. So anyone who's listening who's never been to an opera, come. We would love to have this be your first introduction to this amazing art form.
So can you summarize the plot, like in a minute or less?
I can say this. There's a count and a countess, and they're having marital problems. Also, it's called The Marriage of Figaro. But Figaro is not as important in this as he is in a previous play by Beaumarchais. Figaro and Susanna are going to get married, and the Count decides that he is attracted to Susanna, and he basically wants her and wants to have an affair with her. And so the entire plot is about revealing this in the infidelity of the count. But there's a lot of things going on because in the middle of this, a soprano who's a woman dresses in pants. We call that a pants role. And she plays the part of a sexually precocious late teenager who is in love with a contessa. In the middle of this, Figaro, who was robbed as a child, discovers that two people in the cast, Bartolo and Marcellina, are his parents, but only when Marcellina decides she wants to marry him. So there's a lot of things going on. Lots of subplots. If you can imagine Commedia dell'arte, which is a very physically active way of performing, that is where we're going with this. This will be constant motion, constant acting, and the hours will fly by.
Tell us how folks can get more information about Concertia and also how they can get tickets.
There are two ways to get tickets. You can go online at coralvillearts.org or call the box office at 319-248-9370. Our website is concertia.org, and like us on Facebook. We're posting there. We will have pictures of the rehearsal process. We'll live stream, so it will be exciting to watch it unfold. And please come. Please support the arts. Support these Iowa musicians who are doing one of the greatest masterpieces. If you can imagine Shakespeare and how important it is to see a Shakespeare play, it's as important to see The Marriage of Figaro, one of the greatest pieces that have ever been written, with an Iowa orchestra and Iowa performers. I'll be conducting from the harpsichord, which is very old school, the way I was trained, and that has been donated by the number one harpsichord maker in America, Ed Kotick, and we're so thrilled about that. It will be sung in Italian, but don't let that stop you. We have English super titles, and there will be lots of notes in the program, and the intense acting skills of the Concertia singer-actor troupe will bring this to life.
Concertia's artistic director, Sherry Rhodes. Concertia will be presenting their Marriage of Figaro preview on Sunday afternoon, February 22nd at 2. The actual performances of their Marriage of Figaro production will be at the beginning of next month on Friday evening, March 6th at 7:30 and Sunday, March 8th at 2 p.m. All the events will be held at the Coralville Center for the Performing Arts. We all send our best wishes to Concertia as they focus their efforts and talents to expanding and enriching the art scene in Iowa. The Iowa State Center in Ames is getting ready to roll out the red carpet. On March 3rd, the State Symphony of Mexico will return to CY Stevens Auditorium for a brilliant performance. The president of the Ames International Orchestra Festival Association, Carl Gwiazda, and the Iowa State Center's outreach coordinator, Sarah Compton, share details on this wonderful concert opportunity.
Well, there's always a lot of exciting things coming to the center. We're here to talk about the State Symphony of Mexico coming on Tuesday, March 3rd. And we are excited to welcome them back to Stevens Auditorium. They were last here in the spring of 2008, and we loved them a lot. So we are happy to have them come back and bring their passionate music.
Yeah, it was one of the most exciting concerts, I think, in the experience of the whole AOFA series. Everybody who was there just thought it was great.
So what made it so exciting?
Well, it was the vitality of the playing. The musicians played as though they really loved what they were doing. There was just a kind of palpable excitement that was going on in the hall. And they play with great skill. It's a very accomplished orchestra. So it was the kind of thing that makes a concert-going experience magical.
Carl, give us a little bit of history about orchestras and the Iowa State Center. You have a long tradition.
Yes, actually, the tradition goes back to the opening of Stevens Auditorium, and ever since that time, it has become an annual feature of the seasons at Stevens that there will be usually two orchestras from somewhere, not necessarily outside the USA, but somewhere in the world, and they have come from now just every continent. The fall concert had the Estonian National Orchestra, which was an outstanding group, and now we're going to see the return of the State of Mexico Symphony.
And an orchestra was one of the concerts that kicked off the opening of the Iowa State Center.
It was a series of concerts by the New York Philharmonic, and that event proved so exciting that it became a regular feature. I think it may initially have been thought of as a one-time gala opening, but it became a regular feature and has continued ever since.
So tell us, you have 80 musicians in the State Symphony of Mexico. Tell us what they're going to be performing on March 3rd.
Well, they'll be doing a program that's half Spanish and half German. The first half will contain some pieces by Enrique Granados, a composer of the early 20th, late 19th century, one of the figures who helped to bring Spanish music to international notice. The orchestra will be performing three Spanish dances by that composer, and these are actually just settings of Spanish folk music, and they're attractive works. And that will be followed by a composition by Manuel de Falla that's titled Nights in the Gardens of Spain. And Falla was the composer who I think probably did most to make Spanish music an international phenomenon. Many people may know a work like The Ritual Fire Dance is probably his most famous piece. But Nights in the Gardens of Spain is a work for a piano and orchestra. It's not exactly a concerto because a piano is not so much a soloist as it is a companion in the performance. It partners with the orchestra rather than, you might say, competes with it or tries to sing as a soloist with the orchestra as an accompaniment. But the title tells you a great deal. It's an evocative piece. It is meant to depict gardens in southern Spain in the area of Andalusia. And it has this richly exotic and haunting quality, and you get the sound of guitars and the light and play of moonlight on foliage and on water in these evening gardens, sounds of distant festival. It's a marvelously colorful piece. I don't think there could be anybody listening to it and not like it.
This De Falla piece, I have never heard it performed live, and I think that would be a fantastic opportunity right there.
I am in the same situation. It's been recorded. It's not exactly a neglected piece of the repertory, but it doesn't show up all that often on concert programs. And I, too, am delighted at the opportunity to hear this work. I'm certain that if people do not know it and they encounter it, they'll say, I'd like to hear that one again.
And who will be your guest pianist?
Oh, she's a young Russian pianist, Irina Krisyukova. She was winner of the Ponce competition in Mexico and has been developing a working relationship with the State of Mexico Symphony. So Irina Krisyukova will be the soloist in the firework. So the first part will be what you would expect from a Latin orchestra, but the second part will put them in a different repertory. I didn't mention, by the way, that the final work on the program is Brahms' Third Symphony, which is a really fine work. It's not Brahms at his weightiest or at his most philosophical, but it is a very pleasing and actually very lyrical work.
And wonderful to have 80-piece orchestra performing it. That's going to be a fabulous way to end the concert.
Oh, it's a marvelous sound, the sound of a symphony orchestra. The symphony orchestras are, I think, one of the great human inventions. The idea of getting a group of people, 80, 60, 80, 100 people, all of them focused on making a harmonious sound, and it works. They all come together. All these individual talents and varying personalities come together to produce this marvelous sound. I always find it very thrilling on a sensory level and very satisfying on an intellectual one.
Tell us, Sarah, how can folks get more information and get tickets? And I think you have a dinner involved with this as well.
We do have what we call our overture dinner prior to the show. It's an opportunity for people to relax, have a wonderful buffet meal, and also learn more about the program. Dr. Carl Bliley will be our overture dinner speaker, and the dinner starts at 5:30. Tickets are available until February 24th, when then we have to cut the ticket sales off for the kitchen, so the kitchen knows how many folks we have. But Carl Bliley will present a program about the concert, so we can learn a little more about the music and its influence. And then it's just a short walk across the courtyard to Stevens Auditorium. Tickets are available through Ticketmaster and all Ticketmaster outlets, and you can learn more about all of our programs at center.iastate.edu.
Iowa State Center's Outreach Coordinator Sarah Compton and the President of the Ames International Orchestra Festival Association, Carl Guiazda. The State Symphony of Mexico, under Enrique Batiz, along with piano soloist Irina Krisyukova, will appear at C.Y. Stevens Auditorium on Tuesday, March 3rd at 7:30 p.m. On February 15th, Luther College's Faculty Artist Series will present Music in the Shape of a Pear at 4 p.m. by Dr. Brooke Joyce. Iowa Public Radio Symphonies of Iowa broadcast season also continues on Sunday afternoon at 4 and Monday evening at 7. This weekend's performance features Orchestra Iowa. Today's Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for the show goes to Bernard McDonald, Jennifer Williams-Brown, Chris Mertz, Paul Lichty, John Cook, Sherry Rhodes, Sarah Compton, Carl Guiazda, and Celeste Bembry. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner, Phil Moss, John Pemble, and Garrett Van Leeuwen. Thanks for the show also goes to IPR's Jason Burns and music director Al Scherz. Program research was provided by Nick Carlo, Nick Schumacher, and Stacia Fortunes. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.